This morning, we are wrapping up our series on sharpening the skill of self-control. Now, in doing so, I don't want to give the impression that self-control is a simple matter that's achieved in a few steps, and you're set. As Winston Churchill is often attributed this quote, "Success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It is the courage to continue that counts." You see, self-control is a lifestyle that will see both success and failure, neither of which should be considered permanent. Now, let's be clear. Self-control is not pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. I don't know where that phrase ever came from, but it always makes me smile because it's ridiculous. It's something that physically can't be done, and yet it's a very popular phrase. Self-control is not overcoming one bad habit only to replace it with another bad habit. Self-control is saying no to temptation, and it's saying yes to obeying God. It's what the Holy Spirit does when we yield our will to Him. Now, from the outset of the series, we've talked about how much the Holy Spirit is involved in self-control. He provides the power for true change in our lives. Remember, this was the final component listed in the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5, 22 and 23. So the first step in self-control is to receive the energy that He provides. And remember, as a Christian, as a follower of Jesus Christ, you have that energy within you. It's already there. You don't have to do anything different. It's there. Receive it. Put it to work. But there is a part that we play as well in the process. We must reject the evil that is all around us. Paul wrote in Titus 2:11, "For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men. It teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions." So we must reject the evil. But that verse goes on to say, "And to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in this present age." We must not just reject the evil, we must replace the evil with good. And note the last phrase, "in this present age." We're not just talking about when we all get to heaven. Right now, we can reject the evil, we can replace it with good. So where do we go from there? This morning, we conclude not with the next step of the process, really the recurring steps, and that is to repeat the exercise. Instead of saying just do it, this message says just keep on doing it. This is not a one and done kind of a thing where I've done it, I'm set, don't have to worry about it anymore. Self-control, again, it's a lifestyle. It is an ongoing process for as long as we live. And so this morning, I'd just like to give three helpful tips to keep in mind as we make this a regular part of our lives. The first is be realistic in the face of dreaming. Whether we're targeting a specific practice or we just want to exercise self-control in general, we may approach it with some idealistic fantasies like, this is going to be easy. Or, I'll just let go and let God and He'll do it for me. No, it doesn't work that way. That's not realistic. Now, it's true, we rely on the energy of the Holy Spirit, but we must also put in the work. And that begins with a plan. Now, I don't know anybody that makes a plan to fail. We always make a plan to succeed. Problem is, many of us fail to plan. And when you fail to plan, you are actually planning to fail. If you aim at nothing, you'll achieve it every single time. We've got to have something out there that we're working toward. We need some goals and some objectives. I know some use those words interchangeably. I think there's a difference. I look at the goal is kind of the destination. It's where we want to end up. The objectives are how we get there. It's the direction. So we need goals, but we also need objectives on how we're going to get there. And I believe that having goals is very important. Without goals, we tend to drift. We get carried along by circumstances or by the agendas of other people. Goals give us something to shoot for. Goals help us to keep going when we feel like giving up. They can be like magnets that pull us forward and give us hope. What would be a good goal for our lives? I'd like you to turn to this passage. And if you're one that likes to mark in your Bible, this would be a good one. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. This is a verse I think we all need to put in the forefront of our minds. This would be a good verse every day to wake up and make it a prayer. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 9, so we make it our goal to please Him. How's that for a goal in life? Right? Every day, Lord, this day I want to please You. That is a great goal. You say, well, that's great. How do you get there? Well, those are the objectives. And that is as individual as each one of us. We all have various ways we can please God. But if that's our goal, we're going to see our lives moving in a positive direction. Now, this last week, I looked up that verse in the original Greek. I wanted to know what Greek term was translated goal. There wasn't one. But I did find the word goal in a couple of other verses in the New Testament, and it is translating the Greek word telos, which also sometimes is translated end. Okay? Now, end can have a couple of different meanings. End can mean the termination, the stopping point, or it can also be the intention. It can be the direction that we're going, the end, the purpose, right? And that's what I believe is meant here. One verse where that term is used is found in 1 Peter 1:9. For you are receiving the goal of your faith, the salvation of your souls. Now, goal there is not the end. It's not the termination. It's the purpose of our faith. The destination of our faith is the salvation of our souls. Interestingly, that term is also used in Romans 10:4 that says, Christ is the end of the law, so that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes. And I've heard a lot of preachers say, see, Christ is the end of the law. It's no more. We don't need it. But what if instead of interpreting that as the termination of the law, we think of it as the destination of the law, the purpose of the law, the purpose of the Old Testament? It all leads to Christ, and He fulfilled it. That was His goal, was to fulfill all that God had established leading up to that time. So setting goals is very important. But setting the right kind of goals is even more important. Because we can set up goals that we can't reach, and that just leads to discouragement. Someone has come up with an acronym. You know, it's a word where each letter stands for a different word. And the word is SMART. We need SMART goals. And I want to very briefly this morning touch on each one of those. S stands for specific. Goals need to be clear and unambiguous. It's where we tell ourselves exactly what is expected and why it's important. In that passage that Linda read for us earlier in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 26 says, "Therefore I do not run like someone running aimlessly. I don't fight like a boxer that's just beating the air." He's not just going through the motions. He's not just running around with no aim. You see, if you don't have a destination, you also don't have a route. And so there must be a specific goal. M stands for measurable. We need to have tangible benchmarks along the way so that we know we're heading in the right direction. Break it down. Now, you might have a goal that you want to run a marathon this year. If you wait until the week before Christmas and say, "Oh, I better get started on my goal," probably not going to make it. You need to have those benchmarks along the way where you're progressing toward it. And it needs to be measurable. So that if somebody asks you, "Hey, how are you doing in fulfilling that goal?" you can tell them, "I'm on my way." Or maybe I'm not. Next, it needs to be attainable. Goals need to be realistic. Going back to what I just mentioned, if your goal is to run a marathon and you've never run farther than, you know, from your car to the house when it's raining, and you want to run a marathon next week, that's probably not attainable, probably not realistic. And this is where a lot of New Year's resolutions fall on their face. People say, "I am going to go to the gym and I'm going to exercise for an hour every single day," right? No, you're not. Not at first. You've got to work up to that. It may not be every day or it may not be an hour, but you've got to start. Start small, but make it something realistic. Now, if it's something that isn't even a challenge, something you can do in your sleep, that's not much of a goal. There's nothing wrong with challenging yourself to do more than maybe even you think you can do. But be realistic. Make your goals attainable. Goals also need to be relevant. Needs to be something that matters. I could say I want to read 50 books this year. Average is about once a week. Well, that's fine. But for what purpose? You know, is it going to do me any good? They need to be relevant. And remember, if our goal is to please God, then all of our objectives, all of the smaller goals, the way we get there, need to fit into that overall goal. It needs to be relevant. Finally, it needs to be time-bound. Give yourself time to accomplish it. Because again, it'll just go on forever and ever. Have you seen the commercial lately about the guy that's talking about, is it renovating the kitchen or bathroom or something like that? And he's just talking about it for years and years and years. You see the progression. And he just says, "Yeah, we're going to do that someday." Well, if there's no time put on it, it'll never happen. We procrastinate by nature. And so if we don't give us a time frame, it's just out there. So SMART goals, very important. And setting the kinds of direction we want to go. In addition to being realistic in the face of dreaming, we must be resolved in the face of difficulty. Self-control is not easy. You know why? It's not natural. When we attempt to live for God, when we want to be in control of our bodies and our minds and our mouths, that goes against the grain. We're born sinners. We're already pointed in the wrong direction from birth. We've got to change that and turn it around, and that's hard. It's always much easier to just go with the flow. There isn't anything easy about self-control. It's tough. Again, going back to that passage it was read earlier, Paul says, you know, we've all been to the arenas. We know what it's like to watch the athletes. You know, maybe you watch sports on television, or maybe you watch the Olympics every 4 years. Over the weekend, they had ice skating on. My wife loves to watch figure skating. And it is incredible what those folks can do on skates. I think the same thing about hockey myself. But I guarantee you, what you're seeing is the end product. What you're not seeing is the process to get there. The hours and hours and hours and hours and effort that goes in to what you finally see. It's not easy. And the Christian life is not easy. Because we're going against the grain. Not only we're going against the flow of our culture, it's like we're swimming upstream, but we're going against the flow of our own nature. It's hard. Habits are not instincts. They're counter-instinctive. It's going away from what we naturally do. Most people allow habits to control them. And, you know, habits can come from a lot of places. It may be from childhood experiences or family and friends. You know, they can have a real powerful influence on our lives, but at some point, we got to decide for ourselves how we're going to live. And that's not going to be easy. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13:11, when I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. But when I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me. It's easy to go with the flow and just let whatever take you here and there. But you never make any progress in your life. We need to be resolved in the face of difficulty. Now, once we make a choice to build a good habit, the work has just begun. After that comes a life of continually deciding to grow, of maintaining the right outlook. Because our attitudes have a tendency to revert back to their original patterns. We always want to go back to our default. And our default mechanism as human beings is sin. We're born that way. If you want to use the computer language, we're programmed that way. And it's easy to fall back to that default, but we have to intentionally move in a different direction. And as we work to improve our attitudes, as we're trying to build good habits and reach these goals in our lives, understand there are stages in the process. In the early stage, the first few days are always the hardest because old habits are tough to break. And we have to continually be on guard mentally to take the right action, to keep reminding ourselves, do the right thing when those times arise. Then there's the middle stage. This is the moment when good habits begin to take root. And now we have more options open to us. As we begin to see differences in our lives, now there's things out there we didn't even know were there. And there's more choices. And the choices are, I can do what's right or I can do what's easy. I can do what God says I should do, or I can do what the world is doing and says that I should be doing it along with them. Now here's the good news. The more we choose the right, the easier it is to choose the right. Just like the more we choose the wrong, the easier it is to do the wrong. You can build up momentum with the choices that you make. And when you make a good choice and it feels good, it makes it a little easier to make that choice again. Then you get to the later stage, and that's where complacency becomes the enemy. I mean, we all know somebody that lost a bunch of weight, and then, boy, they gained it right back. Looks like me. Right? Or they want to break a habit. I want to quit smoking, and they've quit 15 times, and they've gone back 15 times. Right? We've all known it. We've all been there. We've got to not let our guard down until that change is complete. And even then, we've got to be vigilant. We got to make sure we don't fall back into those old negative ways. That's why I'm saying this is an ongoing process. This isn't just, oh, got this done, let's move on to the next. It really is a lifestyle of becoming like Christ. But here's the bottom line. I know I say this a lot. If you only take one thing from this sermon, here it is, okay? You are the only one who can determine what you think and how you will act. Let me say that again. You are the only one who can determine how you think and how you act. In our Sunday nights, we have been exploding the excuses about self-control. The excuses people give, right? The very first one dates all the way back to the Garden of Eden. The devil made me do it, right? That's lame. Devil doesn't make us do anything. He can tempt us, but he can't make us do anything. But we also say that about other people. We say that about our parents or our children, our spouses, co-workers, whatever. You make me so mad. No, they didn't. You make me crazy. No. Probably already were. Oh, you make me so nervous. No. Nobody does that for you. Those are choices you make. Now, that statement does two things. It puts an awful lot of responsibility on us, doesn't it? I'm the only one who can determine how I'm going to think and how I'm going to act. Wow, that's a big responsibility. But look at it another way. That's a big opportunity. I am the one who can determine how I'm going to think and how I'm going to act. I'm not at the mercy of somebody else or something else. It gives you hope. If you're trying to break a bad habit or a bad way of living, if you convince yourself that you can't do it, you're right. Not that you can't, but you won't. But when you can understand that, yes, it is within my responsibility, it's within my power, using the power of the Holy Spirit, I can do this. That's liberating. We're going to talk tonight about one of the common excuses that we hear when it comes to a lack of self-control, and that's, it's a disease, right? Oh, I have a disease. Now, there are diseases out there. I get it. When you have a disease, you go to a doctor and they give you medicine or they do a surgery or they fix you. But when it's a matter of choices and you convince yourself you're a victim of a disease, you'll never get any better. You think somebody else has to fix you, and they can't. You're the only one. And the problem that's happening today in our world is that we have convinced people they are victims of their own selves, of their own culture, or whatever it is, and it disempowers them. I don't care what they say about empowering people. When you convince somebody they're a victim, you are doing just the opposite. You are disempowering them from changing their own lives. The good news is you are the one. You are the only one who determines how you will think and how you will act. That's empowering. That's the message we need to be telling the world. Not, you're a victim, you can't help it, it's not your fault, don't feel bad. Which is the whole goal of the disease mentality. We don't want to stigmatize people, we don't want people to feel bad. You know what, maybe we need to feel bad. Maybe a little bit of guilt isn't a bad thing when we're really guilty. Maybe when something's wrong, we should feel like it's wrong so that we'll do something about it. Instead of switching the label and now saying, oh, it's normal. All right, I'll get off that. Started to preach there. What's going on? Self-control is not an easy task. It is going to be difficult, and we've got to be resolved. We've got to understand this is hard. This is going to be a long process. And we need to start from the very beginning saying, whatever it takes, I'm going to do. I'm going to see this through. And then finally, we need to be resilient in the face of defeat. Not trying to discourage anybody, but we're going to fail in our pursuit of self-control. Why? Because we're sinners. Even as Christians, we're going to sin. There's no excuse for it, but we do it anyway. Failure, though, tends to be more public than success. You can succeed at something 1,000 times, but the one time you fail, everybody knows it, right? You can come to a complete stop at that stop sign 10,000 times, but the one time you don't, cop's going to be there and he's going to pull you over. Right? Simple truth is this: no great success was ever achieved without failure. Whether it was Thomas Edison's 10,000 attempts to create a light bulb, or Dyson's 5,126 attempts to invent a bagless vacuum cleaner, I want to know who was counting. Whether we like it or not, failure is a necessary stepping stone to achieving our goals. I began with a quote earlier that said, success is not final, failure is not fatal. Legendary coach John Wooden added to that, failure is not fatal, but failure to change might be. If we allow the failure to define us, if we decide, well, that's just the way I am, and that's the way I'm going to be, yeah, it is fatal. You'll never recover. The moment we're born, we're guaranteed to fail. Bible tells us, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We are born sinful, and we're born into a sinful world. Failure is common to all humanity. So because we cannot insulate ourselves from failure, what matters most is not how we fail, but how we respond to failure. Some of us, when we fail, we get angry at God. Others will look for somebody to blame. We might give up. We give in to self-pity. Or we can choose to learn from our failures. Popular speaker Zig Ziglar said, it's not how far you fall, but how high you bounce that counts. So how do we bounce back? A lot of it's the way we look at things, how we analyze our situation. And one psychologist investigated, why do some people bounce back after failure and others don't? And he isolated three ways of thinking that tend to separate those who can recover from failure and those who just stay in it. The first, he said, is permanent or temporary. People who give up easily believe the causes of the bad events that happen are permanent. It's always going to be this way. And you hear people that say, always or never. This always happens to me. I'll never do well on a test, or I'll never do this right. They think it's a permanent condition. Instead of saying, well, I failed this time, but next time I'll have an opportunity to succeed. Failure, if it's seen as temporary, is something you can recover from. The second mindset is universal or specific. You know, people tend to overgeneralize. And they, if they fail at something, it's because I'm just a terrible person. I'm no good. I can't do this. Instead of saying, well, that attempt didn't work, So maybe I need to try something different, or maybe I just need to try again. As someone that maybe gets into the stock market, they invest some money and they lose it. Ah, I'm a failure. I'll always be a failure. It's never going to happen for me. Instead of saying, well, you know, right now the stock market's volatile, and you know, in the future, things can be better. How do we look at it? How do we perceive it? And then last, internal or external. And this is where, again, people they find things to blame. Oh, it's somebody else's fault, or it's this fault or that fault. It's never themselves. Instead of saying, I can do this better, there's always the blame. There's always something else that's going wrong. Every successful person is someone who failed but did not consider themselves a failure. That's huge. You can fail and not be a failure. You know that? Thomas Edison, who claimed to have failed 10,000 times in trying to invent the light bulb, said, I didn't fail. I found 10,000 ways that didn't work. That's mindset. Instead of allowing the failures to define him and discourage him, he's like, all right, let's try something else. All achievers have the ability to bounce back from an error, a failure. Life is a series of outcomes. But you know, when we give in to those negative mindsets, we actually become very prophetic. When we say, I can't do this, and we believe it, we won't. If we quit, we will never succeed. I shared this morning down at Moroa a story from my own life where this was very apparent. When I was in high school, I was involved in something called Bible quizzing. And I know different churches have different ways that they do this. The church I was in, once a month we would meet and we would compete against other churches. And there would be a quiz of 20 questions that came out of 4 chapters in the Bible. Everybody knew in advance what we were studying. And every correct question would give you 20 points. Now, so no one person would dominate. If you got 4 questions right in a quiz, you quizzed out, meaning you were done. Give everybody else a chance. And if you quizzed out without making an error, you got an extra 10 points. But if you made 3 errors in a quiz, you errored out, you were also disqualified. In my sophomore year of high school, I quizzed out of every quiz the entire year without error all but 3 times. So I was 30 points away from a perfect score. Number 1 quizzer in the district, led our district team to the international finals, and I'm only a sophomore. I got 2 years to go. First quiz of my junior year, I errored out, and I never quizzed again. Walked away. Convinced myself I was no good, I can't do this, and I never saw success again. Because I eliminated the possibility by quitting. We need to be resilient in the face of defeat. Don't give up. Don't quit. Get up and keep moving. Maybe you need to make some adjustments. Fine. But keep moving. Robert F. Kennedy put it this way, only those who dare to fail greatly can ever achieve greatly. You've got to put yourself out there and risk failure. You say, yeah, but I'll look stupid. Yeah, you might. So what? If what you're going for really matters, you'll press on. God hasn't given up on you. Don't give up on yourself. I saw this quote this last week, and I love it. I ought to make a sign of it. Failure should be our teacher, not our undertaker. Oh, I like that. But how many of us bury ourselves when we fail? We're the one kicking dirt on us, not anybody else. We give up. C.S. Lewis had some wise words in this matter. He said, after each failure, ask forgiveness, pick yourself up, and try again. Very often, what God first helps us towards is not the virtue itself, but just this power of always trying again. For however important your goal may be, this process trains us in the habits of the soul that are more important still. It cures our illusions about ourselves. It teaches us to depend on God. We learn on one hand that we cannot trust ourselves even in our best moments, and on the other, we need not despair even in our worst moments, for even our failures are forgiven. Throughout the preparation of this message, I was reminded of a song that I first learned as a teenager. Don't worry, I'm not going to sing it. But I would like to share the words as we close. Don't give up. Try again. This time you can make it. Don't you see all heaven wants you to win? Gather all your courage together and make a final stand. And I know that you can make it this time. You may be scarred, you may be bruised from trying so many other things, but I know that through Jesus that you can win. For the price was paid in full when the spikes went down in the wood, and I know you can make it this time. There is a power that has come to help you stand. It is the Spirit of God sent down to man. If you will just trust his name, your life he will rearrange, and he will give you a reason to try again. Don't give up. The road is long. The road is hard. The road is going to be filled with potholes and failures. Be realistic. Be resolved. Be resilient, and you will see those changes in your life that you're wanting to make.